world's most influential voices are driving the thought leadership and change necessary to take action and reduce the threat and severity of climate change. Join me, Roger Platt, president of the U.S. Green Building Council, as I speak to environmental leaders about the impact of the built environment when it comes to solutions to climate change on my podcast series, Climate Leaders. And we are here with Maggie Comstock from Conservation International, and I have the pleasure of having a conversation with her in the lead-up to the Paris Climate Change Conference. Maggie has been working on climate-related issues and market-related issues ever since she was doing graduate work at Cambridge University, but she also got a little bit of her chops working here at the U.S. Green Building Council for a few years. Maggie, just if you could just introduce your current focus of your work and maybe to indulge me a little bit about how your work at USGBC related or doesn't relate to your current work. Maggie.
Sure. So again, Maggie Comstock. I'm the Senior Manager for Climate and Biodiversity Finance Policy at Conservation International. So I focus on the different sort of international policy fora, the UN Climate Conference that you just mentioned, the Biodiversity Conference, the Green Climate Fund, to see how we can work in these arenas to have nature play a more prominent role and to receive adequate financing to contribute to its full potential for what it can do.
Okay, so when you join the many non-governmental organizations and both national and subnational governmental representatives in Paris, are you coming to kind of speak, in a sense, on behalf of the natural sphere and of the biodiversity that represents? Who are your constituencies? What's your message?
Our message is that nature plays an important part of the solution. Actually, it can provide up to 30% of the mitigation potential that we need to address climate change. And funny that you say the constituency of nature. We actually have, throughout the year, released a series of videos called Nature is Speaking. They're all available at natureisspeaking.org, but you have Julia Roberts as Mother Nature. You have Harrison Ford as the ocean. Liam Neeson is ice. That one was just released a few weeks ago. So these powerful voices are lending, you know, what would they say to us based on what's happening in the world.
So you'll be there, you'll be speaking on behalf of nature, and when you say nature can be 30% of the solution, it almost seems like a understatement, but let me ask you this. Are you talking about sequestration, or what kinds of ways is nature writ large part of the solution when it comes to greenhouse gas emission reduction?
So as you said very well, nature is obviously much bigger benefits. You know, this is an immediate available sector, it's cost effective, and it has countless co-benefits, you know, for the environment, for the people on the services that ecosystems and biodiversity provide. But when it comes to 30% of meeting the mitigation goal, so basically reducing emissions for addressing climate change, that is from in deforestation. Currently accounts for 11% of greenhouse gas emissions. If we were to halt deforestation today, and then to allow forests to regrow at its current rates, that would equal 30% of the emissions that we need to reduce by in order to hit the 2-degree target.
Can you take our listeners through a little bit? When we talk about forests being cut down, there's different ways in which carbon's emitted, even when these forests burn or whatever. But are you talking about the sequestration value of those forests disappears, and that's what creates the big problem with climate change and deforestation? Take us through that so we understand it better, because I want to set that up for your discussion of markets and finance.
So the sequestration that's lost from deforestation is huge, but it also, the activity itself emits greenhouse gases, and there's a lot more carbon in the soil than people realize. So when you do, you know, clear cutting, and often this is for agriculture, that then releases a lot of the carbon that's been stored by the trees themselves, but also in the soil. So it's sort of all of the above. the potential to sequester or to store the carbon in the atmosphere that it can no longer do moving forward, as well as what it releases.
Okay. But when these things are replanted, let's say for agricultural purposes or whatever, do you not get, from a sequestration standpoint, the same benefit? Let's say if it's, just to give you the most typical and sort of worst example, if it's sort of a monoculture of, say, one crop like wheat or something, doesn't that still sequester carbon?
It does in its own way, not to the same potential as a forest had previously. It's also important to think about what you get from those forests beyond just, you know, that greenhouse gas storage. So the water benefits for water quality, purification, and quantity. And so local communities are, you know, very dependent on that clean water. And without it, it's hard to regulate the services that ecosystems such as forests can provide.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. And it's, I got to say, for someone who grew up when Newsweek and Time had nothing but giant cover stories about the death of biodiversity, the end of biodiversity, it's refreshing to hear that there's a group that's still focusing on that, because I don't think that crisis disappeared. I think it just was eclipsed, right, by the climate change issues.
Yeah, and it's they're definitely go hand in hand. You know, the fate of biodiversity is absolutely linked to what's going on with climate change. You know, we think about the effects of climate change, you know, change in precipitation, extreme weather events, drought, flooding, sea level rise, ocean acidification. All of those things affect and threaten ecosystems, biodiversity, and as I was just describing, the services of ecosystems. And that leads to one of the most important parts is, you know, the people. It affects the people that are dependent upon nature for their livelihoods, and actually everyone is dependent on the benefits of nature.
Well, tell us more about that, because one of the issues that has been raised by was raised by Joe Rahm at GreenBuild at USGBC's big conference, and has been raised by others, is that as long as climate change was sort of relegated to the emotionally compelling but not very personal plight of the polar bear or the plight of the most beautiful places in the world, didn't quite have the personalized impact that sort of says to you in the public, hey, I can personally do something about it. A lot of times these discussions about nature seem disempowering to people, but how can we as individuals have, let's say, living in a city or something, how can we have some impact on the biodiversity issues that you're talking about?
Well, everyone interacts with nature in their own way. Another thing is how consumption can affect biodiversity and nature, and the private sector has a huge role to play. Business is, you know, one of the major investors in everything in our economy these mm-hmm. days, and if they're investing in sustainable commodities, for example, Starbucks, they just hit 99% sustainable coffee this summer, which is huge. That transforms this commodity and this entire market.
And does that mean that they've sort of tracked the supply chain in terms of the beans, in terms of the various aspects of the technology that goes into the roasting, the distribution, that they're looking at it for its broader ecological footprint? Why don't you say 99% sustainable? I mean, mm-hmm. What's that mean?
So Conservation
sounds
International,
good.
Exactly. It does sound really good, and it is good. It is very good. So Conservation International has been working with Starbucks for 15 years on exactly that, on the supply chain, looking for the sources of the farms and the beans that they provide, making sure that it's done sustainably with practices that protect the soil and the surrounding environments as well, and understanding how through the supply chain, making sure that those farms aren't clear-cutting forests, for example, in order to, you know, build a coffee plantation. So they've taken this really seriously. It's wonderful to see a company really be a leader on this, and, you know, they're so excited about this. They really want to see coffee be the world's first sustainable commodity.
So maybe that's the easier case, where you have a company that's selling not only coffee, but selling kind of an ideal of a place where people care about good coffee, but also maybe care about community or they're selling a much more than coffee at Starbucks. But for a company that is just selling a routine but important component of our industrial supply chain, mm-hmm. what is it about the fate of nature that would be compelling to them? And can you give us some other examples of people you're working with where it's maybe a little distinct from folks with as big a kind of corporate social responsibility profile as Starbucks?
Right. And so Starbucks is sort of that example of a company that embodies this message and ideology throughout, you know, all of its work in its brand. Mm. But a different example is actually Walmart.
Mm.
They are taking sustainability in the future incredibly seriously. They signed on to the President's Act on Climate pledge, and they've agreed to, you know, ensure that products in their store don't have negative effects on deforestation. And so thinking about how these huge retailers are choosing what products that they sell in their, you know, influential marketplaces, that does affect all of the rest of the supply chain.
Right. Well, that's a great example, and it's a huge impact, I'm sure, as they try to make their suppliers both more responsible and more efficient. That has the co-benefit of probably squeezing their prices down even more. So what is the, when I was really intrigued when I was looking at what you're doing now and your focus on climate finance. And for those who don't understand that term or don't understand how that fits into the current state of negotiations, maybe you can do a little primer on what is it that's at stake in terms of what might or might not be agreed to, even in terms of implementation of the decisions made at the COP in South Africa, I guess, that helps what we're trying to implement here, where climate finance comes into play. Just kind of help the listeners through that, because I think it's really, really important.
Absolutely. You know, when we think about Paris and what needs to happen a week from today,
mm-hmm.
I can't believe it's coming up so soon, is, you know, we need an ambitious agreement. We need to agree on what all countries are going to do to, you know, contribute to what has to happen in order to address climate change. And all of these commitments and actions and, you know, what we need to do ambitiously requires finance. And so in order to...
Is that just by governments?
Absolutely not. So governments play an incredible role in providing finance, of course. They already do in a lot of ways through their official development assistance and beyond that with specific climate funds. But also the private sector has an important role. So that also overlaps with the opportunities governments have to create those conditions within their countries that incentivize and promote sustainable, climate-resilient, low-emission investments by the private sector.
Okay, so that's a bit of a mouthful. The idea, I guess, sustainable investments, I think people would understand ones that carry on and that have the capacity to be sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
But a resilient investment, how's that different than a sustainable investment?
Sustainability is, of course, a large umbrella that includes low emission, which would be sort of the mitigation angle and reducing emissions, as well as climate resilient is when we think about how adaptation plays into all of this.
So you're talking about adapting to a world in which a certain amount of climate change and the resultant weather intensity patterns and stuff exists. How do we have products and even buildings and facilities that can that have adapted to this new reality?
As we think about investments, you know, we need to be looking towards the future of what we need and what do societies and people need, rather than, you know, making investments that would then need to be a building, you know, if you invest now and don't incorporate certain resilience strategies in climates that, you know, for example, might be affected by sea level rise, you know, you would have to reinvest. And so this is about making efficient, smart uses of, you know, finite resources and doing going as far as we can.
Excellent. So we hear a lot about, and you've done a good job of kind of helping us understand the context of why finance will be important, why finance from the private sector will be important. But this Green Climate Fund that we also hear about,
mm-hmm.
I mean, is that something, again, I mean, it's not like the private sector is shaken down to give money to the fund, is it? Or is it that the fund provides a way to leverage private sector money? Again, what does this fund mean?
Okay, so in 2010...
Have to ask these questions as you are a leading expert on this, so we just want to take advantage of that opportunity to Absolutely. Make sure we're understanding it.
Yes, so the Green Climate Fund was, you know, established 2010 by the UN Climate Body in Cancun, and from there it's evolved into a body that has governance... Okay. representing both developed and developing countries. And the goal is for this fund to be one of the main vehicles for delivering climate finance that's promised at Paris, for example, or in other meetings. And so delivering finance means investing in both mitigation and adaptation projects. And the fund has already agreed to split the financing 50-50. 50% for adaptation and for mitigation. And okay. that's actually a big deal because adaptation finance right now is has a very low proportion in the grand scheme of climate finance.
Interesting. So that does seem like a huge development that people should be aware of, that whereas resilience or adaptation is sometimes viewed or was viewed originally as kind of a little bit of a sort of booby prize as things... we're turning in the wrong direction. We have to spend more money on the reality that they are. But now it's really 50% of the funding goals will be in adaptation.
Yes.
Wow.
So I didn't answer the question on the private sector, how it fits into the Green Climate Fund. It's still evolving. Actually, in the first week of November, the fund approved its first set of projects in the lead up to Paris, which of course is a really big deal to show that.
So give me some examples of those.
So
any in France or any in...
So these are all in developing countries.
Oh, got it. Okay.
Right? And so 8 projects were approved. I believe one in the Maldives, a few in Africa. There is green bonds for energy efficiency with the private sector in Mexico and 2 other Latin American countries.
But now in this case, you have, as you say, emerging economies where the projects are, but that doesn't mean that the ones doing the funding are from those countries. They may be in part, but also presumably there's people from so-called fully evolved economies or whatever that are doing that investment as well.
So great question. So countries are actually invited and encouraged to contribute to the Green Climate Fund. And so it's actually a larger pot of money that's available. And you rightly mentioned that these countries who are receiving the funds are in part, you know, contributing as well. There is an element of co-finance. So that means that, you know, the dollars that are delivered from the Green Climate Fund are matched or more with other
sources. So they have skin in the game. Because obviously one of the criticisms here would be just you dump a lot of money on XYZ countries and it isn't always a successful adventure.
Yeah, so we're looking to see paradigm shifting, which is the terms that they use, really transformational projects that are innovative and move the bar for where we need to go on climate change. And so the countries that have contributed to the fund over the past 2 years, those promises add up to $10.2 billion, which is the most that has been promised to a fund. As far as what has been committed, we're at over $5 billion.
Wow.
So that, you know, means that we're able to get projects, you know, begin this process for approving projects.
So in countries like America, where whatever gets committed still has to be appropriated by Congress and whatnot. So presumably in different countries, that's easier to accomplish than others. And U.S. would be in the very difficult to accomplish, I would guess, category.
Yeah, there's a number of countries who are in, you know, this isn't an easy thing to deliver billions of dollars from, you know, really any country.
Right.
You know, everyone is doing their best to deliver to the, you know, highest, most ambitious level.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this. You've been now to countless, but I think we can count them, 6 COPs, is that right, or something like that?
Something like that.
So obviously these COPs are beginning to strike many people as sort of circular adventures in which there's a lot of hope and expectation on the front end, a lot of wonderful consciousness raising through the media, through NGOs like yours. But then there's sort of a general sense that they haven't really quite captured the kind of momentum necessary to really address this issue. What, if anything, is different coming into this COP from, say, the ones even back to Durban and you were talking about Cancun, some of those early COPs that were coming that you attended when you were at USGBC?
Yeah. So looking back to Copenhagen and even before then, the way that this was approached was very top-down. Let's decide on what needs to be done and then tell people what to do. And so Paris and the past, you know, several years, you know, since we've learned that that approach, you know, isn't the most efficient and effective, that we've been looking at this from more of a bottom-up approach. So countries, we have over 160 countries have submitted what is going to be a very wonky term, intended, naturally, nationally determined contributions. What that means is over 160 countries have submitted what are their planned targets for addressing climate change. And that is huge. That is a lot of countries who have delivered, you know, what they plan to do to contribute to this cause.
I think that you did a great job of actually not only spelling out but explaining the term that is this acronym that gets thrown around all the time. What is the acronym? Is
INDC.
Thank you for explaining that, because I think for a lot of folks, we say 160 countries with their INDCs or whatever, and people just don't know what to think. But that makes sense, what you're describing. So you've got a lot more countries that are bringing something to the table. You have this, you say, shift from sort of a top-down to sort of a little bit more of a bottom-up approach. Mm-hmm. But what about, you know, developments in China or even the U.S. or in India? Has anything changed in some of those countries in the last 5 or 6 years that should give us hope? Because I remember at some of those early COPs that we were at together, there was just a sense that without India, U.S., and China a little bit more engaged or committed, that it was sort of an academic exercise to bring all the other countries that even together didn't quite create as much carbon emissions as those three countries.
Well, a lot has happened over the last few years, and if you look to the U.S.-China announcement that they made, you can see that they are taking this seriously and are looking at making specific targets and reduction promises. And the U.S. has done a lot over the last few years to try to deliver on those promises. They have, you know, the power plant rules, looking at how they can shift, you know, building stocks, for example, mm-hmm, something mm-hmm. we know a lot about. Mm-hmm. They are trying to deliver on those. And Paris, as you rightly say, does look at the world in a post-2020. This is really negotiating what's going to happen after 2020. And we also still have a lot of time to act between now and then, which is really important. It's also important to think about Paris as, yes, this is a really important milestone in our climate change future, but it's, you know, another stepping stone to where we need to go. So, you know, this isn't going to be
silver bullet moment.
The end. This is the beginning.
Okay.
This is the road through Paris, and we need to, you know, agree on the level of ambition. But the agreement itself is going to be pretty brief, maybe about 20 pages. And so that means there's not going to be a ton of detail or specifics about how to operationalize, how to get there, how to deliver on what's agreed. And so we need to work on coming up with those solutions and agree on the details in subsequent years.
So you are someone who follows really some of the dynamics here with these negotiations and whatnot. We had a gentleman, Daniel Riefschneider, at USGBC's one of our key lunches at the International Summit. And he was describing a process in which he and another gentleman from Algeria that was doing sort of the initial workup of the negotiated document. And then they sort of ceremonially give it over to the French and what the folks from Peru, maybe, to kind of then move it through this 160 entity, 160 countries and the others that have come to the COP to do the final negotiation. So how important is it that that first draft document, you know, really be 98% of the way there? I mean, I just think, you know, just to give a little credit maybe to some of the staff that work on these. I mean, honestly, how can these leaders really, over 4 or 5 days or whatever, literally produce a document? I mean, it must be incredibly important what Daniel Riefschneider and his counterpart are working on.
Daniel Riefschneider and the co-facilitator of what's called ADP, and it has world's longest actual spelling
right.
out.
But the word Durban's in there,
yes,
I believe.
Ad hoc working group for enhanced action on the Durban platform.
Very good. Okay.
Durban platform on enhanced action.
Thankfully, there will not be a test on this podcast.
Yes. Probably shouldn't include that one.
Right.
But they're the two co-facilitators of this process to develop and then agree on what should be the post-2020 agreement. Mm. And we have been the climate community has been working on this all year long. So some people in this world will talk about Geneva in February. There was a big meeting where the countries came together and communicated to the co-facilitators, Dan and Ahmed, what they wanted to see in the document. That meant a lot of things got put in, and it reached about 96 pages, I believe. And when we need to get down to 20 or less, this is an agreement, that is a lot of whittling down to do.
Wow.
And when you also think about this is really an exercise in, you know, legal nuance, word for word type mm-hmm. agreements, discussions, negotiations, and adjustments, it's very difficult. So we've actually had, I'm trying to count, February, June, August, September, and October meetings, which we worked on this text to get it down. So currently, we're at 55 pages. And Dan, the two co-facilitators have been guiding this process, assigning other countries to take the lead on different themes, for example, you know, finance. And so we've been working as quickly as we can, but progress in this process is incremental. And there is a lot to do between now and the end of Paris, but that document is definitely the foundation for what, you know, will hopefully become the Paris Agreement.
Well, one of the things I just want to acknowledge here is that it's really remarkable. It seems as though you are, and the Conservation International is, being able to help advise players that are right there in the negotiation. You're also, it sounds like they're open to getting some of your feedback on this in this process. So I'm kind of impressed that the UN is making good use of those beyond just their individual members, that they really are staying true to some of this rhetoric about the non-subnational players or whatever. And so it sounds like you're really getting to have an impact. I think that's really exciting. I think most people feel that it's a black box, this whole negotiation stuff.
It is really exciting, and Conservation International and many other organizations also do a lot of scientific research in developing countries and conservation on the ground. And so a lot of our role in the negotiations is to take those scientific findings and our lessons learned from implementing mitigation adaptation projects in countries. Again, our focus is more on the nature solutions to climate change. How can, you know, forests contribute, or ecosystem-based adaptation. For example, you could build a mangrove, or, you know, restore mangroves in coastal regions that are particularly vulnerable to extreme weather events, but that also can support local fisheries. So those nature solutions and what we've learned can then be translated into this process to help build a stronger and more robust agreement that also recognizes the importance of nature.
Well, this is great, Maggie. I think we've kind of come full circle. It sounds like your organization is having real impact. And is there anything else we haven't talked about that you want to mention?
I didn't answer your question about USGBC. My experience working at USGBC over the years has taught me a lot that I've been able to apply to my new job. Obviously, you know, green buildings, infrastructure, energy efficiency doesn't have a lot of obvious overlap when it comes to forest conservation, for example. But the way that USGBC and the green building movement is thinking about solutions, particularly the finance models for doing so, is very innovative and is actually one of the most advanced, I guess, sectors for delivering climate action through innovative finance. The energy service company models, where an energy service company will make the upfront investment for example, a public school. The school will continue to pay its normal energy bills, no additional cost to them, And once the energy service company has received, you know, a modest return on investment, they deliver the reduced bills to the school, and they have now the benefit of lower bills and photovoltaics, for example. So these models aren't immediately transferable to nature, but it does allow me to think about the solutions in a very new and different way. Thinking about, you know, if green bonds can be part of the solution, or other ways, payments for ecosystem services, for what I've learned in our other financial models and innovations, how this can be applied in creative ways.
Well, that's great. And obviously, buildings and finance, because the buildings are the collateral for the finance, that's all very connected, and I'm glad you're able to get some exposure to that. But it's clear to me that this that you've taken it, and Conservation International has taken it to another level when they're dealing with the more complex issues around finance and deforestation and whatnot. So thank you for all your hard work and for that of Conservation International. We're certainly really impressed by what they're doing and look forward to seeing you and your colleagues in Paris in just a few days.
Thank you, and I look forward to seeing you at the COP.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Climate Leaders. Join me next time for more insights from the world's climate experts as we explore the outlook for achieving COP21's bold objectives.